I'm Christopher Ludden, and this is Open Source with Ophelia Dahl of Partners in Health, with Dr. Dan Palazuelos of the Brigham and Women's Hospital, who's back and forth to Mexico, and the nurse, Pat Doust, between MGH and East Africa. They're bringing home some news, some lessons, some linkages from the far field of global medicine. The trends are striking. Of the new medical doctors coming out of U.S. medical schools in the mid-80s, 1 in 20 had spent some real time abroad in healthcare. 10 years ago, it was 1 in 5. Last year, it was 1 in 3. So more and more doctors, yours and mine, acting locally, will be thinking globally, with many implications. Consider this. For example, Bill Gates' foundation report this winter predicts that there will be virtually no more poor countries by 2035. That's two decades out. We'll just have a lot of poor people in sort of middle-income countries. We know that problem in the United States, and we haven't turned it around. But there are clues for us out there, and there are lessons coming home with these young doctors. Lessons in community care, outside the big hospital ERs. Lessons in accompanying care, in prevention. Lessons in doing more with less, in getting much better outcomes. Also in putting moral urgency behind more effective care for everybody. On our website several days ago, we asked people, doctors especially, what's to be learned from working in the developing world? Here is some of what people said.
Young doctors who are training in America, if they go to a place like Cambodia, they will learn how to manage in a setting where you have to actually listen to the patient and do a physical exam to make a diagnosis rather than relying on $1 million MRI. And you also learn the universality of medical problems because these are poor people who have the same problems as we see in the U.S.
What we're learning is simply that healthcare is a human right. And we learn to have high expectations that it is absolutely possible to bring first-class health care to poor people here in the U.S. and in places like Haiti, and that it's our responsibility to work towards that goal.
We've learned that if you don't take access into account, millions of people won't be reached, whether it's in Ethiopia or in the poorest, most rural communities of the United States. You can always build a health center, but without well-trained staff and a community able to access services, then nothing has been accomplished.
Working in a resource-limited setting takes away the middleman in medicine, and it teaches you to rely on your own examination skill and knowledge as a physician.
Of many things that doctors learn working overseas, most importantly, they learn optimism. They work close with communities in team structures that are much more flat and collaborative. And they come back with a sense of what's possible, and they infuse that sense of hope into our own system.
Imagine that, doctors having to listen to the patient and do a physical exam. Listeners, lots more of you have takes on these questions. Join the conversation this hour at 800-423-8255. We're talking about the global health outreach from Boston specifically. Our guest, Ophelia Dahl, first went to Haiti 30 years ago to work in an orphanage for handicapped children. Her father, Roald Dahl, was the author of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and a whole shelf of masterpieces for children of all ages. He encouraged Ophelia, he said, to see another side of the world. Many sides of it by now. With Dr. Paul Farmer, Ophelia Dahl founded Partners in Health, a global network today of new thinking and new practice built to serve, not least, as they put it, as an antidote to despair. Ophelia Dahl, welcome to Open Source, and thank you for being here. Paul Farmer speaks of the mortality declines, specifically in Rwanda since the genocide, as the most spectacular, sharpest drops ever recorded anywhere. Do we know why? I start there as a sort of introduction to what you're doing, what we're learning.
Good to be here. Chris, it's hard not to be. I'm thinking about one of your callers just now who said talked about optimism. It's hard not to be optimistic when you focus on steep declines and gains in life expectancy, such as being seen in as is being seen in Rwanda. I think it's the answer is not a simple one. In many respects, it's about paying attention. It's about connecting to governments and ministries of health. It's about accompaniment. It's about investing in systems and infrastructure. It's about all of those sort of that long, as Michael Porter would say, value chain of expectations and building systems so that people actually get the care that they need in the community and link it all the way across to a system of centers and hospitals.
Take about that one word, accompaniment, a bit of a buzzword, but it's important and it resonates. What does it mean to you?
It means it's a bit of a Rorschach test, actually, in many ways. It means a lot of different things to different people. To me, it means proximity. It means connecting to it. It means being beside someone or a community and walking with them, shoulder to shoulder, giving people what it is that they need. It's not usually a quick exchange that people need, especially if they're sick. It's a lengthy connection. And I couldn't help but think about this word accompaniment. It didn't occur to me until I'd been doing this work for years and years that people who are sick need often a lot of care, and it's not just being given the medicine. It's often being taken to the hospital or connected to physical therapy and that kind of thing. And I was thinking about my own mother, who had been sick when she was quite young and had young children. And I realized she had a stroke and became paralyzed and couldn't speak. And I realized actually at some point that my father had sort of maybe even unwittingly devised a system of accompaniment for her when he connected her back to family and community and realized that she was accompanied through the recovery of her stroke. And I just put that together after I realized how much time we spend in the community with our patients. And it was rather profound to me, having not really being very conscious when my mother was so ill, but learning about it when I was older.
That's very important and touching. I'll take the Rorschach test. When I hear accompaniment, I hear the Book of Ruth in the Old Testament and the all sorts of disasters in the family, orphans and widows.
Yeah.
And Ruth says, "Whither thou goest, I will go.
Yeah.
And where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people and thy God my God." Franklin Roosevelt's emissary to Churchill's cabinet at Lend-Lease quoted the Book of Ruth, and Churchill wept. We will be there with you. So apply it. Where does one find an accompanier for people who need a hand held?
Well, they come in every possible stripe, as you can imagine. I mean, there's not a school for accompaniment. It's learned as it was learned. With me, it was learned on the job. It was learned. I felt as though I got a great apprenticeship, actually, in Haiti, visiting people and then seeing what accompany actually meant, to be inside someone's house, connected with them as you actually are walking with them along the path of their life. Seeing what some people actually have to face every single day just to get water. Those kinds of things. If you accompany someone down that path and you go with them to places that you wouldn't normally go, in fact, I would say a lot of the times it's much easier to avoid that, then that's what it's about. It's really not, I have to say that the hard part about it is it's not a conditional thing, accompaniment. It's really a very unconditional, unending in many respects. You know, one of the things that are great friend and colleague Paul Farmer has often said that the accompaniment doesn't end when the accompagnateur decides. It's when that person being accompanied decides it ends. That's a hell of a journey in many respects and can be very complicated.
We've spoken of Haiti. We've spoken of Rwanda. Partners in Health is many other places. Speak of the accompaniers, the community health structures, the successes, the failures. In the rest of Partners in Health world.
Yeah. You know, the broad piece about accompaniment is that although, and I know that we can get a little bit specific here with community health workers, which is very important as it's rooted in the community, but also important to know that, you know, accompaniment takes place through our partnerships with the Brigham and Women's Hospital, through Mass General, with Harvard Medical School. It takes place with, carpenters and electricians. So it's really very broad. It's a long-term partnership in many sense. The accompaniment that we've concentrated most on has been building up a large cadre of community health workers that are connected to a system. So any one of these different pieces within this system, and I think system and structure is sort of important in this, because you can't have a clinician unconnected to clinics and tools and therapeutics and all the rest of it. So you can't have community health workers unconnected to a system, which is from the community into a clinic and then into a hospital. Those pieces, and then, of course, you have to have them connected to, supply chain and all of those other pieces. But the community health workers for us early on, a couple of decades ago, was an aha moment in many respects. And certainly it wasn't Partners in Health who thought up the notion of accompaniment by a long shot. But finding ways to make sure that when your patients have numerous barriers to getting into clinics and seeking care, it's not thought of as non-compliance, really. It's thought of how can we help to get these people for whom life is a very, very difficult series of obstacles, then throw in sickness, ill health, poverty, all of these things, and the accompaniment piece becomes not optional, but absolutely essential.
How much of the high-tech, modern scientific Brigham and Women's medical thinking goes with Partners in Health abroad?
As much as is necessary, really. I think the coming to this work early, several decades ago, there's no question that it felt as though the solutions were sort of keep it simple. And one of the things that we say at Partners in Health is, you bring the fruits of modern medical science to those who need it most. You don't say that we'll only do oral rehydration without also looking at fixing the system of access to water and that sort of thing. So we bring lots of modern equipment, therapeutics, CT scanners, anything that's needed to help people really get better.
We're talking about, with Ophelia Dahl, about global health, Partners in Health specifically, Dr. Dan Palazuelos and the nurse Pat Doust, catching up this hour on big trends, including some astonishing victories in global health. In Rwanda, as we say, the sharpest gains in maternal and infant health and the biggest drop in AIDS mortality ever recorded. Our guests represent that Boston outreach that bears eventually, it will, on healthcare delivery in New England too. Dr. Dan Palazuelos lives two lives in medicine. Half the year he wakes up with the roosters in the Sierra Madre Mountains of Mexico in an underperforming clinic in the impoverished state of Chiapas. The rest of the year, he practices clinical medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he teaches public health at Harvard. Pat Doust was the mother of five, a visiting nurse in suburban Boston 30 years ago when the AIDS epidemic struck and then radicalized her thinking and her work, first locally, then globally. She's the chief of nursing in the SEED Global Health Initiative, working with Dr. Vanessa Carey out of Mass General. Our phone is 800-423-8255. Here's a very simple, practical question for listeners to react to. If you could pick your doctor, one who's just come from a robotics clinic for 5 years, other who's been working in East Africa, who would you want to be nursing you and your family? Dan Palazuelos, take us to Chiapas and the scene that you operate in half the year.
Well, I'll start by, I think, broadening a little bit more the concepts that Ophelia brought up about accompaniment. I think accompaniment structures the way that our part of Partners in Health works in Mexico. We're called Compañeros en Salud. That's utilizing the local, I think, idioms and language to say Partners in Health. And we approach a lot of our relationships and the way that we proceed with trying to get outcomes with the concept of accompaniment. For example, we work with young Mexican doctors who are doing their social service year. We take them in, educate them, give them a little bit more of a salary, even go visit them, live with them side by side in these hopefully not underperforming government clinics anymore. Then one step further, we are now about to launch a new cadre of community health workers who we call compañantes. accompaniment in community health workers could either be an approach. It could be, you know, the acompañante goes to the person's house and does a sort of dots. So the accompaniment could be nothing more than I saw you take your pill, but it's usually a lot more. It's a relationship. It's that extra something that humanizes that little chalky white thing that goes into your mouth and hopefully controls a theoretical number like a blood pressure.
How do you, Dan, act differently with those patients than you would with patients at Brigham and Women's in terms of aggressiveness, in terms of knowing things, in terms of going to their houses, in terms of touching them?
You know, for better or for worse, I think that my clinical practice is the same here in Boston as it is in Mexico. For me, and this is also cross-cultural, for me, the human interaction is really eternal. And it is the thing that allows me to sit at the bedside in a place where there's beeping going on and I have an MRI that right at my fingertips with just a couple of keystrokes, or a place where, you know, the patient might have taken a donkey ride for 2 to 3 hours in order to get to the clinic. It's that moment of quiet, that moment of sitting, thinking, listening together. Mm-hmm. The important thing is whether or not in a hospital like the Brigham or in my primary care practice in Boston, if I'm given the time. For me, it's approach and the philosophical approach that a doctor or another clinician brings to the question is one part of it. But more importantly, it's also what are the systems that we practice in and how does that influence what we can do with the patients in front of us?
I always go back to something Dr. Bernard Lown said to me, wrote in his book, The Lost Art of Healing. A great cardiologist said that the most important medical device ever invented is the taking of a personal history by the doctor, and the most important treatment ever devised is the laying on of a doctor's hands on the patient's body. These things don't happen much anymore, whether because of time or technology. I think people still long for them. Are you more likely to get that and to administer that in Chiapas or in Boston?
I think I definitely try to do laying of the hands, take a good history and physical in any patient that I have in front of me. I think that some of the lessons that I've learned in Chiapas, working with young doctors there who inspire me, teach me a lot of times new approaches to physical exam and otherwise, I hope that I bring those back into the residents that I work with at the Brigham. I try to teach them, too, how they can get the most out of their physical exam and their history.
Pat Doust, you speak for nurses and about nurses, and you were involved deeply in training nurses. You went to East Africa originally because of the AIDS epidemic. What are you learning and what are you bringing back, both in the way of outcomes that we ought to know about and then in approaches?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for having me at this table.
It's
I am a true nurse advocate, so I am going to speak on behalf of nurses.
We trust nurses. Doctors sometimes.
I think everyone agrees that in many ways nurses are the backbone of our healthcare system, both here and across the globe. So once again, thank you. The AIDS epidemic had me out of my comfort zone right here in our own backyard of Boston. As you said, I was in the suburbs. I was a visiting nurse. Suddenly, I was confronted with these diagnoses of GRID at the time. That's how far back that was. And I entered a new world. I was outside of my comfort zone quite significantly in a community that I was not familiar with.
Mm.
And it took a long time for us to begin to trust one another. And then as I began to pursue the career within the AIDS epidemic, we all know that the epidemic epicenter switched to Africa, and that's what drew me there. And it has been something that I've not been able to give up.
Where did you begin? And then bring us to the point where you're mainly engaged now in building their capacity.
Sure. So I began in Botswana and with the Harvard AIDS Institute. And at the time, I worked with nurses there, nurses who were seeing opportunistic infections. They were seeing the AIDS epidemic like they had never before, and they didn't know how to treat it, and we did. We knew this. So then I evolved loving the education of nurses across the globe. And that's what I do now through Seed Global Health.
Speak of the nurses, the wannabe nurses, the capacity that wants to be built among young women and I suppose men too in Botswana. Who are they?
It's a very interesting group. To be honest, nursing in the developing world is often not seen as a well-acknowledged or respected profession. Oftentimes, these young men and young women, it's a fallback for them. What we've been able to do, by I say we, the volunteers that I work with through SEED and the Peace Corps, which I'll talk a little bit about, we go over and we not only teach and educate, we advocate for nursing as a profession so that at the end of the day, they are proud of their profession. And I think that in of itself is very, very important. And they then have the confidence to provide that hands-on, excellent care that you're going to see a community, the health outcomes improve. When you were talking earlier about doctors and the hands-on care, I think nurses have always provided hands-on care.
Yeah.
We never moved too far away from that. And so when I see the back and forth, yes, we don't rely as significantly over there, when I say over there in Africa, on those diagnostic tools. But for many of us, that's not that different or that sort of nuanced type of care.
How do you build a community health structure out of young nurses, new nurses?
New nurses there?
Well, no, I'm just thinking, how do you go from the individual to the community capacity that we're talking about?
So I think a very holistic approach to patient care is something that nurses bring to their patients wherever they find them. Nurses are in the community as well as in a hospital environment. So we have cut across all lines of reaching our patients. So when I say community-based care and lessons learned, I want to sort of bring it back here to Boston to a certain extent.
Please.
So the first community health center in the United States was here in Boston, Columbia Point. And this was designed after the community-based clinic that Jack Geiger, a physician from Tufts, saw in Africa, in South Africa. We've been bringing back and forth lessons learned since the 50s and the 60s. So what we bring back now, it's just building upon those lessons, that bilateral opportunity to share. So nurses have always been in the community. We've never left the community. We didn't have to go back. We've been there.
Give us the short course, three main points of what you would tell Jack Geiger now, what we know in 2014, how to build a successful, nothing much worked at Columbia Point, and I'm old enough to remember a lot of it. What do you know now does work?
What I think works is we really have to educate our clinicians in a way that, as I said before, has them look at a patient from a holistic perspective, not just that disease that's in front of them, but also all of the housing, the nutritional status, the poverty, the educational status. And that's how you build community, because then you can actually address that patient from those different aspects. And so nurses have had to learn how to look at the patient beyond the person's standing in front of them. But it's been an easy educational process because I think it's sort of innate to the profession. When we work with the nurses through our partnership with the Peace Corps, we have right now 30 nurse doctors, Peace Corps volunteers that we've recruited and trained with Peace Corps in Tanzania, Malawi, and Uganda. They're in the educational system, they are teaching the next generation of nurses and physicians in these countries, building the capacity in those countries. And they're doing it from a community as well as a clinical hospital approach, because that's how you give the care in these countries, and that's what they bring back.
The matter of the holistic view, not only of the whole person, but of the setting, the family, mm-hmm. the poverty, the jobs, or whatever. It's my cue to mention Cuba, and the Cuban doctors brought American doctors and Boston doctors are not the first and they're not the only ones. Cuba has 40,000 doctors out there in the world. I had an extraordinary experience 3 years ago with African-American women training in Havana. They'd been there 5 years, getting a very different standard, but they're doing the same, they're facing the same sorts of situations that you are out in the world. And one of them said to me, they were so happy in the work they were doing. These were empowered American black female people with a something of the revolutionary ideology of serving humanity. But Akua Brown said to me, doctors here in Cuba not only do house visits, but they go into homes. They have a form you fill out to check off what risk factors the person has in their home. Is their water contained properly? Do they smoke? We get that kind of first-hand view. In the U.S., you can ask someone if they smoke or if they have a pet, and they can easily lie to you. But here, as someone's primary physician, you can see not only the physical medical aspects, but the psychological medical aspects as well. Do you feel tension the minute you walk into the house? Are people in a mentally healthy environment? Do we need to get them to a psychologist? All these broader measures, and Cuban medicine is very aggressive, very interventionist in asking the tough questions. And they also say it all starts with the community model. Tear and compare. What do you learn from that should we say two-fisted intervention?
I think that there's a lot of lessons. There's a lot of lessons that we can learn from that Cuban model. And most importantly is that health is not just what you get once you get sick. Health instead starts from a full continuum of the social determinants, prevention, early diagnosis.
I was going to say, what about prevention? How do you teach it, deliver it? Market it, so to speak, train it in Chiapas.
Well, I think to speak of the Cubans, and I think we implement some of similar ideas, the system allows them to get that close to the patient. They have around 200 families that are assigned to them, and their daily job is to walk the beat, to go to the houses, to get involved in people's lives that way, as opposed to the primary care doctor in the United States who has 15 minutes and 2,000 patients. In Chiapas, our young doctors that are now working in these government clinics are the doc of the town. And these are small towns locked away deep inside the mountain range with only a dirt road connecting them to anything else, any other towns, internet, cable TV. And they do a very similar job, and they do it as well. They are intimately integrated with the community. In fact, so much so that one of our young doctors, when he finished his social service year, the entire town lined up in order to give him a hug and say goodbye, one by one.
What I'm hearing is that it's not a choice between high-tech, cutting-edge medicine and community care. It's the hospitals need the community care to have anything like a sort of realistic approach to the problem.
Oh, it's all of those things without question. The you know, thinking about the Cubans again, you know, being able to bring a really different standard of care to a place like Haiti. I mean, in many ways, the missing link is the medical education piece of this. If we've brought anything to these different countries and these communities, the idea that the lasting change will come from affecting medical education on all of those levels. So the training and linking the delivery piece in a way, which is what Partners in Health does, the implementation, to be able to link it then to research and training or education. That's, you know, whether it's community health workers, doctors, nurses, all of the pieces, technicians along that chain. I remember well being in Haiti and meeting a whole host of Cuban physicians who came there, gave up 2 years of their lives, often left family, came as Spanish speakers only, not Creole speakers. And I just watched them in the different communities. These very, you know, in many ways, underfunded areas and doing what they could. And they were used to a much, much more robust system.
Ophelia, I want to know why we don't have a community health care structure here. The rude question to Partners of Health would be, why are you building it over there before we know how to do it in Dorchester?
We'd love to. We'd love to be a part of that. And I think have made different forays out into the community and you know, perhaps haven't haven't, you know, funded it enough, haven't been involved enough into it, looking at where that crossroads is right now, something Partners in Health would love to be involved in. The missing link, I think, to bring this conversation back together is the community health worker piece of this.
Yes.
So you've got, in the places in which we work in, say, you know, rural Malawi or rural Haiti, you've got the community health workers and sometimes the clinic. You often don't have the tertiary hospital. Here we have all the tertiary hospitals you can imagine and the community health centers. You don't have those links into the community. As you said, the home visits are in so many ways, as everyone here can tell you, that they're the bedrock of what it is we do, going into the homes.
I think there's a this is a guess, but there seems to me a certain strategic genius for Partners in Health to start in the faraway, to start in the developing world, that we may be able to learn a kind of egalitarian compassion at a distance before we know how to apply it at home. That's just a guess. We're talking about global healthcare and the Partners in Health piece of it with Ophelia Dahl, Pat Doust, a nurse at MGH and also in East Africa, and Dr. Dan Palazuelos, who works in Chiapas in Mexico half the year, the rest of the year at Brigham and Women's in Boston. Can I just say, I feel so many convergences here in this big story of global health, and they're broadly of the medical side of life and the, I don't want to say the church side of life, but a more theological, idealistic, philosophical appreciation of where we're at. But it's a convergence between Bill Gates' interest and the Pope's interest. It's a convergence between Paul Farmer, a medical doctor, not an ardent believer that I know, but working with Father Gutierrez, the Peruvian champion of liberation theology and the preferential option for the poor. There's a convergence even in that phrase. That was Father Gutierrez's phrase, the preferential option for the poor as our brothers and sisters, God's children, and all of that kind of thing. But Paul Farmer would say, no, there's a preferential option for the poor because that's where disease lives and stays alive and threatens us all. So we have to pay attention there first. There was a meeting at the First Church in Cambridge early last week, Tuesday night. It was absolutely bursting with people, and there the convergence was literal. All the theological schools, including BU and the Harvard Divinity School and whatnot, were there in force. Young people with their ambitious lives ahead of them, and the medical school kids too. There were Rwandans and Haitians too. But Paul Farmer was speaking with David. I'm going to miss his name. Speaking in effect for the Divinity School, and they didn't cross into each other's zones, but there's an alliance here, and it's part of the hope you speak of, Ophelia. Do you sense what I'm talking about?
I do. It's hard not to feel all of these things, including some sort of difficult to describe spiritual connection to all of this. And I work at a secular organization with many different people with all different faiths, and they come to this work, and it's very hard not to feel some real connection to this, in terms of, because you're so close, this proximity idea, this idea that you don't do this work from a high platform. You actually get down and you roll up your sleeves and you go to where the disease is, or you go, if your mission is a preferential option for the poor in healthcare, as it is at Partners in Health, then it is naturally going to lead you down these pathways to where those people who are often leading lives of terrible suffering with enormous burden of disease. And I think it's important to keep your eyes on that, as we try to do.
I felt there was a certain over-daintiness about even speaking of the obvious convergence here of morality and humanity and everything we want, believers or not, when they look at the face of the Pope or when they think of the work that your doctors are doing. And maybe it's just as well that sort of church and state can work independently together. But I just feel there's a sort of double strength in this moment and this movement and this interest. The phone is 800-423-8255. We're talking about global health and what American doctors abroad are bringing back home. Nancy is calling from Middletown, Rhode Island.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Welcome. Good, Nancy. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. It's been very interesting listening to the conversation. I'm actually a volunteer with the Peace Corps SEED partnership program that Pat Douse there is representing.
Where do you work? In Malawi, this is. Yeah.
I'm in Malawi, yes. I'm stationed in Malawi. I've been there since July. I'm back home here, actually, for 2 weeks, and then we'll be returning. I think what I'd like to comment is really to kind of confirm what was just said about the human element of this all. When we are over in a third world country being faced with extraordinary needs and suffering, and particularly in the healthcare system, of course, we're so exposed to it all. I think we can't help but use our skills, but our spirituality in being able to process what our experience is and what we do bring back here to the States when we practice again. But it's also something that we leave with our patients there. There is a sense of a shared humanity that we're reaching out. We as a foreigner who's coming here with certain skills and the desire to help, that gets translated, and that, I think, on a humanity level, increases, the entire, sense of civilization.
Nancy, what would prevent you from doing what you do in Malawi when you come back to stay in Middletown? How will you apply it?
I think I'm a much more compassionate person. I think I've seen things and been experienced in situations where I'm astounded at what other people in this world have to deal with. And it makes me more humble. It makes me more compassionate. And I think that will be translated. I'm a psychiatric nurse. And I think that I can't help but be more empathetic and understanding. But I can also give others a perspective of the human experience that we all have, whether you have depression in the U.S. or whether you have a depression in Malawi.
What are the symptoms of depression in Malawi?
They're very similar. You'll find people will isolate themselves. They will stop eating. They disconnect from their children. I've heard that quite a bit. They don't talk. They don't socialize. Malawi is very family-oriented, so it's very often that a depression is picked up pretty quickly by the community, by the sisters, the mothers, the aunts, the uncles. But there's literally no real mental health care treatment system in Malawi. So the treatment really comes through the family members, and often successful, but oftentimes not successful.
I just wanted to make a comment. First of all, hello, Nancy. It's nice to hear your voice. Nancy's one of our volunteers who is going to be in Malawi for a full year before she actually comes home this summer. And she's been in Malawi, and all of our volunteers are embedded in the community. So although they work within an academic institution and they're training the next generation of psychiatric nurses, they live and work in that community, and they become part of the community, which is how they can see the full picture. And as she said, she's a guest, and they recognize her as a guest. But after a year of day in and day out, they really learn to respect and trust her, and she's done a really phenomenal job, as so many of our volunteers had done.
Pat Doust, I wonder, what we think of as our Western, I'm speaking of mental health, but neurotic problems or psychiatric problems, do you see showing up or appearing in Africa that we never much thought about before, including as life expectancy rises, the diseases of old age?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course you do. We're universal. We're all one. But as Nancy said, there is a sense of community. We go out to the community here. the community often comes with the patient to the hospital. You don't go to a hospital in any of these countries and see a patient alone at the bedside. That patient is surrounded by family, because the families are also the caregivers. So as the clinician, as the nurse, as the physician, you get to know the family, even though you may not have gone out to the village and sat in the patient's home. So the community is one big ongoing continuum. You see these mental health issues. It's just, unfortunately, many of the treatments that are available here are not there. And so you do have to, as Nancy knows, use alternative. Maybe you spend more time talking with that patient and working with that patient as opposed to medicating that patient.
Nancy, it was a wonderful start. I mean, it's so interesting to congratulations on becoming a more compassionate person, but you're in a setting where you have to notice more. You have to see more of the human story. How we would love, to tune that back up in our own practice. We're talking about what American doctors in their 1, 2, 3 year sojourns in the underdeveloped world, the developing world, can bring home, must bring home. The phone's 800-423-8255. Marilyn is calling from Newton, Massachusetts.
Hello, Chris.
Welcome, Marilyn.
I'm very moved by the topic that you brought up tonight, because it's something that's on my mind a great deal. And it's what I feel is that what we can learn from what Paul Farmer knew and what the people who go and work with him understand is that the most important thing in any kind of healing relationship is touch, warmth, words. Bernard Lown wrote that a long time ago. Words can kill. Words can make you healthy. Today we have a health system in our country. Our very, very rich country has millions of suffering people in it. And they go to a doctor, and the doctor is told by the office manager, 7 minutes, that's it. This is not healing. This is technology, but it's not healing. And I would like to say that, I'll give one example. My own example, I suddenly developed, as a result of a very severe pneumonia, atrial fibrillation, and I was seeing a cardiologist before then for labile blood pressure, and so I went to see this cardiologist, and I was stunned when the cardiologist said to me, well, you'll go on Pradaxo, which is a new form of anticoagulation, a drug that had been on the market for a year and a half and had already come out with many, many reports of incidences of extreme bleeding, and said, well, why don't you take it and come back in a year? So yeah. I walked out, and I thought, well, I'm not seeing that person. Well, I went through that a couple of times, and I finally made contact through some people who had lived next door to a cardiologist who was chief of medicine in one of our leading hospitals in Boston. And he walked in, and he sat down, and he said, well, I really need to take down the facts and put them on the computer, but I don't think I'm going to do that. I'm going to turn my back to the computer. And I almost fell off my chair, because that's what you see these days every time you walk into a doctor's office.
And then he said?
Yes. And then he said, tell me a story. And he sat there for an hour. We've never had an hour since. But in that hour, I developed enormous trust, and he's been my doctor for some time now. And I'll tell you one other thing, that I had recently a nuclear stress test, because I have mobility problems, and I can't do a regular stress test. And 2 hours after I got home, on my email, I got a message that said, Marilyn, thank God, you're fine.
Go back and tell your other cardiologist, Marilyn, and thank you for the story. I want to ask you all about Bill Gates' annual letter in which he says virtually the problem of poverty out there is solved. Poor countries, I should say, is solved. We're in sight of a monumental breakthrough in which life expectancy will come to approach ours, infant mortality. Do doctors believe that stuff? I mean, how much of that is verifiable? And how does it guide you in your work?
Oh, I would say that it's we're so close. I mean, you know, there are so many things that are available now. And, you know, one of the things we refer to is the delivery gap in many ways. This is about delivery. We've got the vaccinations. We've got many of the therapeutics. In fact, a whole number of the deliverables have been around for a long time. It's really, in so many ways, a failure of imagination to go to that. It's the idea that we can actually take these therapeutics. We can go to all kinds of lengths to get things to people here. We've got everything we need. The systems are there. The medical education piece, the community health workers. There's definitely the enthusiasm and to be able to do it. I think Bill Gates is right on. I mean, there's a huge amount that's still left to do, but there's a great deal that's being done already.
Pat Doust, we want to hear the nurse's verdict.
Okay. I've read Bill Gates' letter, and I love the fact that he is promoting ongoing global health funding and that we are, in fact, making huge strides and huge differences. One of the things, and I agree with you, Ophelia, we do have what we need. We don't have the people to deliver. There is a huge shortage of healthcare workers in each one of these countries. It's a crisis. And I think that's where the gap lies.
How about in this country?
We have a shortage, but let me tell you, it is all relative. When you look at the numbers here versus the numbers there, and I have them written down somewhere if you'd like to know them.
I take your word.
going back, though, to the training question, because I think it's really important, and Dan's seen this firsthand, the shortage of people, once now that there's a training model, once you can actually get people involved in, you know, there are more nurses in Manchester, United Kingdom, than there are in Malawi. But once you start offering the training programs and the tools to be able to do this, you actually see the reversal of a brain drain that's been extremely inspiring to witness. So, yeah, the total agreement. But getting that training going is very important.
But getting that training going is very difficult. There is a 60% shortage in faculty in many of these countries within medical and nursing schools, which is why the program that I'm working with, Seed Global Health, we actually send nurse educators, physician educators into these academic institutions because they are very important if you're really going to have a next generation of those people who are able to deliver.
And you've got to change the system. You have to be able to build that within the medical education system. Look at the nursing schools and medical schools in these countries. Often they're four-year undergraduate programs, if that. So you've got to find ways to robustify that.
Dan Palazuelos, can you see the goal? Is the goal in sight in Chiapas?
You know, it is. And the amazing thing is that global health is an opportunity to share lessons across these different sites. So the challenges of one country in terms of shortage in human resources are going to be met with challenges in other contexts, like in ours, where we have, you know, reimbursement problems and others.
Thank you all. I feel better already. Thank you, Ophelia. Thank you, Dan Palazuelos. Thank you, Pat Doust. Listeners, continue the conversation on our website at Radio Open Source. Share your own experiences, your own recommendations. Our show is produced by a team of young radio doctors, the Global Millennials, Kunal Jasti, Max Larkin, and our engineer, George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our Surgeon General. I'm Christopher Lydon, the orderly on the ward. Join us next time on Open Source.